From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Untrained as an artist, yet gifted with an eye for the way objects and images fit together, Joseph Cornell never learned to paint or draw. Instead, he built small wooden boxes and filled them with collages and objects collected over years of treasure hunting in secondhand stores. He worked alone and almost never left New York City.
If all that makes Joseph Cornell sound like some idiosyncratic outsider or folk artist, he was not. Cornell was among the most influential American artists of the 20th century. The mysterious little worlds he created inspired everyone from pop artists like Robert Rauschenberg and Andy Warhol to contemporary installation artists.
Next month marks the centennial of Cornell's birth. An exhibition of his boxes has just opened in New York. David Darcy reports.
The Crystal Cage is a collage of scraps of paper and black and white photographs in a glass case 3 feet across. There's a large picture of a white pagoda, a photo collage within the assemblage of dozens of faces and recurring images throughout of a young girl with short dark hair. It could be a shrine to a character in one of the fairy tales that Cornell loved, or a kind of travelogue with little maps here and there. Art historian Dick Krontoshtian sees a story in these fragments.
This is the Crystal Cage, which is an actual pagoda that exists in, or existed, I think it might still exist, in France. And he uses this particular photograph as sort of the setting for the story that he establishes, which is of this little girl, Berenice, who is brilliant, a scientist, who lives in this tower. I pause there because it's difficult to create a narrative beyond that.
For years, people have tried to piece together logic from scenes that Joseph Cornell pieced together with scraps of fabric, dolls, clocks, clay pipes, and photographs. He acquired his materials on his solitary trips to Manhattan junk shops. The small centennial show at Richard L. Feigen Gallery in Manhattan has 20 of the constructions Cornell built with those fragments. Some of Cornell's boxes are stage sets. Some are forest landscapes with tiny trees and dolls wearing garlands of twigs. Some are geometric grids all in white, or grids that repeated rows of tinted blue photographs years before Andy Warhol did it with Marilyn Monroe, and lots of images of birds and women, especially young women. Most of the boxes are on loan from Washington, D.C. collector Robert Lehrman.
Cornell liked to try to see the world, as children do, without the blinders that we unfortunately get as we grow older. Cornell loved children, loved their innocence, and felt that they were the spiritual leaders that we should emulate.
Art historian Dick Krontoshtian.
As a Christian scientist, he believed in a deity that was both male and female. So we have this notion of male-femaleness in human beings as well. So when we're talking about little girls, we're also talking about little boys. This is sort of a universal genderizing, I would imagine, spiritual genderizing.
Some scholars call Cornell a religious artist. He became a Christian scientist in his 20s when the stress of supporting his mother and his disabled brother after his father's death made him physically sick. In his work, he looked to the heavens for relief, with boxes that are meditations on infinity, sometimes with little metal bars between a white room and the starry skies outside. Cornell's microcosms have fed a mythology that focuses on a solitary life spent almost entirely in a small house on a street called Utopia Parkway with his mother and brother. That's led to all sorts of speculation about his sex life, says Linda Hardigan, who's written extensively on Cornell.
There are a few women who maintain that they had actual sexual relationships with Cornell, and that's their privilege to state. But the fact of the matter is that while his mother and his brother were alive in the house, it was difficult for him as a Victorian gentleman, and I want to stress this. He really was a Victorian gentleman, and he also, I think, subscribed to the idea that when you are a creative individual, if too much time and energy is spent in sexual activity, that actually drains your own creative resources.
He was more of a quiet, private, frail man than a recluse, Hardigan says, a thrifty man who gave boxes away to little girls and waitresses, a craftsman who hated machines and refused to learn to operate a camera, even though his boxes and collages are full of photographs, and even though he later made movies that spliced together existing frames from films other people shot. but he had an appetite for images of everything that was as far-ranging as his imagination, says Walter Hopps, who worked on the Cornell catalog raisonné, an inventory of his work.
Once a surrealist critic named Nicholas Collis saw Cornell in a store, a department store in Manhattan, at the lunch restaurant area, and he was studying a slice of white cake with a magnifying glass for some kind of geographic formation. Seemingly, he had a most unusual range of interests. I bring that up because to most people that would be absurd. Examining a slice of cake with a magnifying glass makes no sense at all. But Cornell, it did.
And it made sense for Cornell to have people hold his works. One of the boxes on loan from Robert Lehrman contains a piece of wormwood and fine red sand, which flows over the wood when you turn the box over. Other boxes had drawers which were meant to be opened, or sand fountains, as Cornell called them, that were meant to flow into special shapes. Collector Robert Lehrman.
Cornell would create a sand fountain, which is approximately the size of a shoebox. Cornell, in this box, has created a mesmerizing metaphor of the sands of time, with a starfish in the great blue sea or a star in the heavens. And when this sand fountain comes to rest, we'll see a pyramid made of sand. What better metaphor for a monument made by man to withstand the passage of time than a pyramid made of sand? This is something you can't see if the box is in a museum. The sand will not collect in an active and kinetic fashion.
At the Richard L. Feigen Gallery in New York, the boxes are bolted to pedestals or to the wall. In 3 years, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. will try its hands at displaying the works Cornell assembled in his basement. Cornell considered and rejected the idea of turning that house on Utopia Parkway into a museum. He thought memorializing himself that way would cost too much. Now, collector Robert Lehrman says Joseph Cornell's biggest box is just another basement in Queens.
There is no vestige of his alchemist's ways left in that space. It has been renovated, it has been sheetrocked, it has been subdivided. There is no lingering essence of the artist's creative touch there.
Joseph Cornell died of heart failure in that house on Utopia Parkway on December 29, 1972. For NPR News, I'm David Darcy in New York.
You can see pictures of some of Cornell's boxes at our website, npr.org.